I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show. I am Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. My first guest, Dr. David Hanscom, is a board-certified orthopedic surgeon specializing in complex spine problems in all areas of the spine. He has expertise in adult and pediatric spinal deformities, such as scoliosis and kyphosis. A significant part of his practice is devoted to performing surgery on patients who have had multiple prior surgeries. He works for Swedish neuroscience specialist in Seattle, Washington, with 8 neurosurgeons and a physicist. Dr. Hanscom completed his medical degree from Loma Linda University in 1979, a residency in internal medicine in Spokane, Washington, from 1979 to 1981, an orthopedic surgery residency at the University of Hawaii from 1981 to 1984, a 6-month orthopedic trauma fellowship in 1984 at UC Davis in Sacramento, California, and completed his spinal deformity fellowship in Minneapolis, Minnesota at Twin Cities Scoliosis Center in 1986. He is the founder of the DOCC Project. It stands for Define, Organize, Comprehensive Care. This is a structural rehabilitation protocol for chronic pain, which involves improving sleep, managing stress, engaging in long-term conditioning, obtaining adequate pain control with aggressive medication management, resetting goals, and educating the patient so as to regain control of their decision-making. He is also the founder of the Puget Sound Spine Interest Group, which was formed in 1987 as a nonprofit educational group which provides a regional forum for physicians to share ideas regarding optimum spine care. Awake at the Wound is a process which brings athletic performance principles into the operating room. He co-founded that program with his golf instructor, David Ellamy, in 2006. Dr. Hanscom has written many articles, and his latest book, Back in Control, A Spine Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain, published in 2012, is still a top seller on Amazon. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Dr. Hanscom. And I look forward to hearing about avoiding spinal surgery and living pain-free. Now first, Dr. Hanscom, why do you say that most spinal surgery should never have taken place in the first place?
It's interesting because a very high number of spine surgeries are done for back pain. And the most recent common cited is degenerative disc disease. Mm-hmm. We don't know a lot about back pain, but what we do know is that there's multiple research studies showing there's no correlation between disc degeneration, bone spurs, arthritis, and back pain. Mm-hmm. Yet it's one of the most common reasons for performing a spine fusion for back pain. The success rate of a spine fusion for back pain is about 25%, and it's just a dismal number, and no series has seemed to rise above that. Everybody seems to get better for about 6 to 12 months, and mm-hmm. then at about 12 months, the results start falling off dramatically. By 2-year follow-up, the success rate's about 22 to 25%. Mm-hmm. What happens then is that the spine starts breaking down above and below the fusions. Then you create a whole series of structural problems created by the first operation that probably did not need to be done.
Mm-hmm. That's a shame.
But I would estimate maybe 60% of spine surgery should never be done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why are doctors doing so many needless spinal surgeries?
Well, part of it's a tricky combination of things. First of all, paid well to do surgery. I can't fault anybody for doing mm-hmm. what they're paid to do. Mm-hmm. Second of all, the patients sort of demand a solution to their back pain, and there are other solutions besides the surgery, but somehow surgery is held out both by physicians or to physicians and the public as a definitive answer. Well, it's a definitive answer if you can see the problem. Mm-hmm. One example I use frequently is if you go to the dentist with a painful cavity and get the tooth fixed, of course, the result's about 100%. Mm-hmm. If you go to the dentist with mouth pain without knowing exactly what the source of the pain is, success rate drops down dramatically if you start doing random surgeries in the mouth. Same thing with back surgery. I do a lot of back surgery for structural problems, which means I can see the problem, the symptoms match, the success rate in that situation is probably 90-95%. I quit doing fusions for back pain about 1993 and just dramatically changed my practice, and success rate just went up through the ceiling.
That's great.
But it's what we're trained to do. The shorter answer to your question is we're trained to do surgery, we're paid to do surgery, the patients are demanding surgery.
Right. You have an alternate approach to avoid surgery and help people live pain-free. Can you tell us about this?
Well, I was very interested in your website. It's essentially, in some ways, what you're doing is that we do know when the nervous system is hyperreactive and sensitized, that it simply perceives pain in a much different perspective than when you're relaxed and in a good mood. And what happens, we just find out there's different factors that affect pain, is that sleep, lack of sleep affects pain. In fact, they actually can create muscular pain by depriving volunteers of stage 5 sleep, which is dream sleep. Stress affects pain. If you're in a lot of stress, your body chemistry changes and you perceive the pain signals more. You basically amplify the signals. Physical conditioning makes a big difference. If you are repetitively moving your muscles, there's a better blood supply. Inflammation goes down. The soft tissue connections seem to increase in density. There's also probably a neurological substitution process that makes a difference. So when I look at your website about things that you do just to treat your body in general, why it's really the same thing applies to pain. And so we simply use the common sense solutions approaching pain. It's been very, very effective.
And how did you develop your method?
Well, I suffered chronic pain myself for about 15 years, with 7 of those being extreme. And I just got very lucky. I happened to read a book on sleep. And the point of the book was that only 5% of physicians treat sleep. So I said, well, I can do this. I took a very surgical approach to sleep and started prescribing Ambien. Most of my patients started feeling better. And about 20% of those patients back when I first started this went to pain-free. And I go, well, that's interesting. Then I worked on my own sleep, which helped some. I then understood the role of the somatic tools somewhat inadvertently, is that we find out that pain pathways in general are permanent pathways. You can't solve them through traditional stress management psychotherapy. But there are ways of using what we call somatic tools, connecting thoughts with physical sensations, that starts rerouting the pathways. So I started these simple writing exercises a long time ago. It's basically you're writing down negative thoughts and throwing them away. It came out of Harvard in 1987. And what you're doing with that process, your pain pathways are permanent, so are anxiety pathways. And as you actually write down your anxiety-producing negative thoughts and throw them away, you're not getting rid of them, but you're separating from them, and the separation is now connected with vision and feel. There's something about that process that's very powerful. It happens to be the foundation of the entire project. And after 13 years of chronic pain myself, it happened to be the one tool that started to break things loose. So that's how the whole process started. So there's basically 3 parts to it. Basically, the first step is simply to learn about pain. The second part is to address every aspect of chronic pain at the same time. In other words, there's never one solution for chronic pain. You have to address every aspect at the same time. Then the third part of it is you take complete control of your own care. Once you understand the variables that affect pain and address them all at the same time, and you take charge of your care, it's just a matter of time before people start to calm down and feel much, much better. So we've seen hundreds of patients go absolutely to pain-free. So it's not a matter of managing the pain. People really do go to pain-free.
That's great. Is your process just for back pain, or can others who have
pain? There's over 30 symptoms of what's called the mind-body syndrome. During my worst part of my ordeal, I had 16 of these at the same time. Some of the examples of mind-body syndrome are eating disorders, irritable bowel, spastic bladder, migraine headaches, ringing in the ears, burning sensations around your body, insomnia, tendonitis, etc., PTSD, fibromyalgia. What happens when the nervous system is fired up, basically short circuits, the pain thresholds are changed, each organ system will respond in a different manner. People have a hard time thinking, well, the pain symptoms are all in my head. Well, guess what? When you're under stress, basically anxiety, your body chemistry changes. You have cortisol and adrenaline firing away. And when you relax, you have chemicals like dopamine, serotonin, and oxytocin that are being released, which calm things down. So when you're in an environment of high cortisol and high adrenaline, every organ system is going to have its response. That's not imaginary. Those are real physical responses. So it's thoughts that create the stress, that create the chemical secretion of these hormones, that create your body's physical response. So yeah, all 16 of my symptoms are basically gone. Mm-hmm. If I quit practicing the tools, basically my writing exercises, which I do probably 3 or 4 times a week, mm-hmm. my symptoms come back. I get these skin rashes start popping back up, and my migraines start coming back. Mm-hmm. And if I am just fairly diligent about doing simple mm-hmm. relaxation exercises and the writing exercises, I'm really more than fine. I'm actually thriving.
Mm-hmm. So it's a holistic approach. That's really great. I like that.
Right. That's why I was very interested in your process. And, you know, mm-hmm. I'm trying to get this into mainstream medicine. It's not that hard, and your approach obviously makes so much sense. Of course, your story is very compelling.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so if you haven't slept for a year, which a lot of my patients, before they make the decision to try to do spine surgery, they maybe not have slept for 2 years, been abused by the workers' comp system.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody believes them. They're very frustrated. And then they try to make a decision to do a major operation that has a success rate of about 25%. It doesn't make any sense.
Mm-mm. No, no, not at all. No. How long, then, does the process take in order for the patient to see results?
You know, everybody's different. I'm doing a seminar or workshop this summer at the Omega Institute mm-hmm, mm-hmm. in New York. It's about a 5-day seminar. We did it last year at Omega. My wife, Babs Yochai, Dr. Fred Luskin out of Stanford, and myself put the seminar on.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a combination of things, like creating structure, interaction, videos of hope. And we found out that if people just relaxed and started talking to each other, because people in chronic pain become very socially isolated, we had all 11 participants go to pain-free in 5 days, which was very unexpected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then they relapsed, which we predicted. But a year later, 10 out of the 11 are still doing just fine. So we see some changes without the workshop process, you know, within 2 to 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Usually by 3 to 6 months, people are well on their way. It really depends on their openness to engage. I mean, the biggest problem we've had by far is that people, believe it or not, at the deepest level, really don't want to let go of their pain. It's a familiar pattern. It's powerful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's incredibly frustrating for me is that I see what the possibilities are, yet people just steadfastly will not engage.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, with open engagement, it's very, very consistent, and it happens relatively quickly.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting because I remember from years and years ago something about the patient role and how mm-hmm. there's certain rewards for being in the patient role and how patients don't like to give up those rewards. So
right.
That's a powerful, you know, incentive to stay sick for some. Now, do you think that being in a group facilitates this process, or does it work the same with individuals, or doesn't it make any difference?
I think it's a process. I think everybody's different. What we did at Omega, we made a very safe environment. People could relax and talk to each other. We created mm-hmm. a buddy
mm-hmm.
system.
Mm-hmm.
But almost every person in chronic pain has pretty extreme social isolation. They can isolate from their family, their friends, their peers, and
mm-hmm.
they may
mm-hmm.
go to work and function at some level, but they're really in a pretty dark spot. What I think had happened is that the human brain really evolves and is developed with interaction with other human beings. And I think what happened in Omega is that people basically healed each other. In other
mm-hmm.
words,
mm-hmm.
the book creates a structure. And as you know, creativity occurs within a structure. It can't really occur in the face of chaos.
Mm-hmm.
So we created a structure people could share and talk to each other. And it was great. If somebody is in chronic pain, though, and to go from being isolated into a group setting right off the get-go can be very intimidating and frustrating, probably somewhat counterproductive. So I think everybody has to go through this on their own terms.
Mm-hmm.
The key issue is that people do take charge of their own care and take full responsibility for their issues.
Mm-hmm.
The long answer is saying, yes, I think group is ideal, mm-hmm. but not if you're not ready for it.
Mm-hmm. I find that often when I'm around people that my own problems or my own aches and pains kind of disappear. But, you know, there are times when that works and times when it doesn't. So I guess, you know, it's not only an individual variation, but also a time variation. The other thing I wanted to ask, and that was, does the length of the process vary by the disease process? So that, like, migraine headaches might take less time than, say, fibromyalgia?
I really honestly think it's the openness to engagement is the key issue here. So what happens is it's not a fixing process, it's a shifting process. So other symptoms of mind-body syndrome, by the way, are anxiety, anger, mm-hmm. bipolar, et cetera, mm-hmm. eating disorders, obsessive thought patterns. So two of the people in our group had severe bipolar for over 20 years. and within 5 days they were fine. Mm-hmm. And I think those are incredibly resistant processes to treatment. Mm-hmm. One of the problems we found out with anxiety, for instance, we treat that as a psychological disorder. It's actually a core symptom of the mind-body syndrome. It's really a neurological issue. It's a pathways issue. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing is that once it's a shifting process, not a fixing process. In other words, these are permanent pathways. It's like riding a bicycle. So you're shifting off those. What we realized with this process, when you're connecting these thoughts with physical sensations, you're creating alternate pathways to these permanent pathways. The other thing that happened, though, at Omega was that I realized my own journey about 2 years ago that pain pathways are permanent, but so are play pathways. Mm-hmm. In the course of life, chronic pain, anxiety, et cetera, play pathways tend to get very, very buried, but they're in there for everybody. You don't have to make those up. By shifting to play pathways, it's a very, very powerful, fast way of coming off your pain pathways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. Then, is there anything else you would like to say about pain or your process before we look at your books and services and products?
Well, it's not a formula. I get emails all the time say, well, I read your book, I still hurt, and mm-hmm. I understand that. Mm-hmm. But this is a process of connecting with the best part of who you are. And what happens in chronic pain is always connected with anxiety and frustration. In other words, a metaphor I use a lot is if you put your hand over a hot stove, you have anxiety and immediately pull it back. If I took your hand and forced you to hold it over that hot burner, mm-hmm. not only would your anxiety go up, but you become angry, of course, because you're trapped. Mm-hmm. So in chronic pain, basically you're trapped by the pain. It's incredibly frustrating. Dr. John Sarno in the 70s called this rage. And again, your whole nervous system is really fired up. And when you're that angry and frustrated, it's all about you. It's mm-hmm. a survival mm-hmm. response. So what happens, anger is a complete disconnection from you, from the people around you. And what happens is what this structure does allows each person in their own individual way to start becoming aware of what pain and anger is doing to them, what it's doing to the people around them, and they start reconnecting to the best part of who they are. And it's a process, but it can happen very, very quickly. But it's not a form. It's about reconnecting to the best part of who you are. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the slides I use is of a wild tiger being released on the back of a pickup truck in Africa. And of course, the intensity of this animal breaking out of that truck is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But that's what happens with this whole process, is that once people reconnect with who they are, where they want to go, what they want to be, I just have to get out of the way. Mm-hmm. So this is really, in some ways, not a formula at all. It's just a structure that allows yourself to climb out of the hole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another question I didn't think of before, but do patients then come back on a regular basis until the pain is gone? Or do they see you once and take it from there, or how does that process work?
Well, ideally, it's a process. Even though people are pain-free, it's definitely an evolving process. I've been on this pathway for about 17 years myself, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. I'll just tell you the last 6 months have been as huge a paradigm shift as probably the first 5 years mm-hmm. of the entire project. Mm-hmm. In other words, your brain's building new neurological circuits. We call it neuroplasticity. Your brain actually forms new nerve cells. That allows you the capacity now to learn even more. So there's no end point. Ideally, when I was doing this by myself, I'd see people back every 1 to 2 weeks or mm-hmm. 3 to 6 months to get them on track. Mm-hmm. And maybe every a few times a year after that. So I think it's important to have sort of a coach is what I would look in my role at that point. Mm-hmm. What I do now, since I'm back in a busy surgical practice, I have two physicians at my pain center that will take people through a 6 to 12 month process. And again, probably 90% of it self-directed, but it's helpful to have that 10% to get some encouragement, some coaching, medication management, et cetera. That being said, if you look at my Amazon website and see the different reviews and stuff, there's many, many people that have never met me. They've read the book, gone to the website. And there is a website, by the way, called back-in-control.com. That's a self-directed process. It has 5 stages. First stage is anxiety. Second is anger. The third is becoming proactive. The fourth is getting organized. And the fifth is regaining your perspective. And it's about a 1-year process. Each stage is about 10 weeks. But mm-hmm. usually within 6 to 12 weeks, things begin to happen pretty quickly. My personal frustration is people actually by stage 2, sometimes stage 3, are a lot better and they quit. Well, of course, the best part is the regaining your perspective, becoming creative, et cetera. So really, it's a process that's ever expanding. But again, it's about, by definition, fairly self-directed.
Great. Good. Then would you tell us about your books, services, products, and how the listeners can locate these?
So I did write a book called Back in Control, A Spine Surgeon's Roadmap on Chronic Pain. Basically a combination of my story, my patient stories, creates that framework that you need to understand pain in general. So again, the first step is simply to learn about pain. The second step about addressing every variable is outlined in the book of how to access your physicians, different medications, et cetera, to solve your own problem. And then there's a website that I just mentioned that is not linear. It's basically intended to take the same concepts, use a combination of videos, stories, et cetera, to give you different angles on the same concepts. Because you're really trying to sort of stir up your nervous system and get to different aspects of the same issue. But the website evolved from my patient successes. I realized about 3 years ago that my patients that were getting better were sort of doing it without me, which is a little bit humbling, of course. But it evolved from my patient successes and my successes. So it didn't really happen because I said, you should do this, this, and this. It's very much supposed to be entertaining, enjoyable, different, thought-provoking, et cetera. But that's basically it right now. I have a practice course in Seattle that's a surgical practice. And when people do call my office, I usually send them to the pain center, and I'll do consultations to make sure there's not a surgical problem. By the way, backing up way in the story, as a surgeon, I never assume anybody has mind-body syndrome on the first visit. I always check for structural problems. In fact, I'm more hyper about checking for structural problems now than when I first started the project, because I don't want to miss something that's cancer, tumor, infection, pinched nerve, or something like that. So we're extremely careful, you know, to make sure that variable is covered when we first evaluate you.
Great. Good. And do you have any telephone conferences or things like that?
I think the thing that's been a wonderful experience, if people, I know 5 days out in the summertime is a tough deal, but on August 10th and 15th, we'll be putting on this same workshop at Omega, which is really a remarkable experience, extremely unexpected last year, about people getting better so quickly. And then everybody's different. I mean, people will come out of the seminar and not necessarily be better, all of a sudden 3 minutes later be a lot better. But the seminar is really a remarkable experience. But that's August 10th through 15th. It's actually on my website. You can register for it on the website.
That's great.
But
because you're on the West Coast, and that brings you to the East Coast, and they have some great things at Omega. I follow what they do there.
Yeah, plus it's just a beautiful spot, really incredibly nice people, and just a really nice week. But, and it turns out, by the way, that my wife is a professional tap dancer, Balinese mask dancer. She also has gone to clown school. So she's a very interesting combination of rhythm and movement talent. She's also a mime. And what happened, we learned this rhythm called the cup song, which I had never heard of. It's all over the internet. And we just started learning this rhythm, and we just started to laugh. And really what happened, in a lot of ways, we provided structure, companionship, didactic, videos of hope, but really is that sharing this experience together that people basically healed each other. So we relaxed, opened up, really the word play came into play in a very powerful way. And that's what really caused this shift, was that people healing people through the through play.
And Dr. Hanscom, would you give us your website again?
It's www.back-in-control.com, backincontrol.com with hyphens between. And again, it's very self-directed. I always do encourage, I put on the homepage a Getting Started section, which starts a process of these writing exercises. This came out of Harvard in 1987. It's if you write down your negative thoughts, throw them away. And the reason why you throw them away, you actually destroy them, is not to get rid of them. They are permanent pathways. But it starts a separation process. It starts connecting the thoughts with physical sensations. Every person that gets better does it a completely individual way, except the one common tool has been the writing. Nothing really starts until the negative writing starts. I spent 20 minutes this morning doing my writing, and it's like brushing your teeth eventually. And we find out now with functional MRI scans that writing is a very complex neurological process. And for some reason, after 13 years of my own ordeal, it was the one thing that started to break through this whole process.
That's great. Well, I appreciate this very much. I always like to talk with people that are using a holistic approach and also that are using an approach that's much less invasive and that is sometimes more effective than the invasive. And it sounds like this is more effective than some of the surgeries that have been performed. So this fits right. Wonderful and what I like to have, you know, on my show for the listeners. So I appreciate this very, very much.
Can I ask you a question for a second?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm just very curious. I looked at your website, and of course, it's a very holistic approach. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. There's a paper out recently that shows that alternative medicine, which I don't necessarily think holistic medicine is alternative, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I think mainstream medicine has missed this.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, obviously, you figured this out a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just curious your experience using the holistic approach. Obviously, your own story of healing is compelling. But I'm just curious your take of looking through my material, seeing what you've already done. I'm just curious what your thoughts are.
Well, it is holistic, and that I think is so important. And I'm finding that more physicians are moving toward the holistic approach. So it reinforces that, you know, what I used 40 years ago was the right approach. And the reason I used it was because of my background in public health. At Hopkins, in the School of Public Health, we were taught that there are multiple factors that lead up to a disease process in man, the agent, and the environment. And so, you know, because not everyone that smoked got cancer, and not everyone that was exposed to the tuberculosis bacillus got tuberculosis, etc. So
right.
It seemed that if there are multiple factors that lead up to a disease process, then there have to be multiple factors that resolve that process. And so, you know, when the doctor prescribed the physical aspects for lung cancer, it seemed to me that there was a lot more than the physical. And so that's why I decided, well, you have to look at the mental and the spiritual and add, you know, prayer, meditation, visualization, affirmation, serving others, a lot of non-physical things to that process in order to reverse it. And
right.
It worked for me. So,
yeah, no, it's a very, very compelling story. It just, you know, what happens, and that's why I am working hard to bring it to mainstream medicine because, you know, as you know, when you simply calm down the nervous system with meditation, different other tools you described, your body chemistry changes dramatically.
Definitely.
And your immune system is going to respond differently. Obviously, you can't really cure cancer without an incredible immune system response. And if you're under stress, of course, while your immune system is compromised, there's a study, I just wrote a website post called Destroyed by Bullies, and I started a recent reference where they looked at people who were bullied, and there's a lab test that you're aware of called the C-reactive protein, which measures inflammation. It was significantly elevated in people who were bullied. Then they looked at the C-reactive protein of the bullies. It was significantly lower than even people who had never been bullied.
Huh.
So that stress response is right there. Your body, there's a very significant inflammatory marker right there that gets elevated with that kind of stress, chronic stress. It's not so hard to understand the body's going to physically respond with some pretty terrible diseases under chronic, unrelenting stress. And I always tell people stress isn't the problem. It's the reaction to the stress. What you're doing with this whole process that I'm doing is if you create a little bit of space between the stress and your reaction to it. And I'm not into positive thinking at all. I'm into positive substitution where you have to actually absorb the negative, understand it. Then you can substitute a more positive alternative. What happens when you're under a lot of stress and just pretend it's not there or try to get in a positive thinking mode, it really fires up your nervous system. And there's a little bit of a subtle difference with this process. And I'm assuming, I'm just guessing that you understand it perfectly. But you can't pretend something's good when it's really bad.
Right.
And so really absorbing the anger first before you move forward is really key. That's what the writing, we think, starts that process.
Well, I think part of it, too, may be the what they're now calling epigenetics, which, again, is the major influence of your thoughts and all on your DNA and how you can influence these. And, you know, people have been talking about the mind-body connection for years. Bernie Siegel has been working on it for years. Dr. Contreras' father You know, Ernesto Contreras worked on this. And so I'm so happy that physicians, more of them, are picking this up. And, you know, you mentioned calming the body. I interviewed a Dr. Take from California and a Dr. Khan, who are cardiologists, and they're finding the same thing with cardiac patients, that it is as important to do Tai Chi or yoga or meditation or some of these things that calm the body as it is to prescribe the traditional medications. And Dr. Take told me that her goal, she may put patients on medications, but her goal is to get them off and treating this more naturally and without drugs, if possible. So, you know, I think that it's really an exciting time to be connected with the healthcare field, where people are seeing this as a holistic approach.
Right. I mean, your public health background, of course, is a really big deal. I mean, it's something that, it's nice to have individual people do this, but you look at the, you know, eating disorders are up, anxiety, so there's all sorts of things that are really elevated, and trying to get this out on a widespread basis is really, really critical.
Right.
So, anyway.
Yeah. Well, again, I appreciate this very much, and I hope that when your next book comes out, we'll talk again.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you.
Bye.
My second guest, Joyce O'Brien, and her husband, Kevin, were both diagnosed with late-stage cancer within a five-year period, and her husband was also paralyzed after a brain hemorrhage. Faced with their devastating diagnoses and fear of leaving their baby girl an orphan, Joyce, an executive vice president on Wall Street, left a successful 18-year career to begin her healing journey. 10 years ago, Joyce and Kevin were blessed with healing stage 3B and stage 4 cancers, chronic fatigue, depression, and more. Joyce's life mission became clear, and she invested years in training, research, and studying with the doctors and experts in holistic health to discover many of the secrets of what makes us sick and how we heal. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Joyce, and I look forward to hearing about your late-stage cancer 14 years ago. Now first, can you start by telling us a little about your story?
Yes. Well, I was in my early 30s, and I was down on Wall Street living a very crazy kind of lifestyle, what you would imagine, high stress, busy, long hours, not necessarily taking care of myself. And in a five-year period of time, my husband, who was 31 at the time, had a brain hemorrhage and 3 strokes and was paralyzed.
Ooh.
And a year after that, I was pregnant with our daughter, and the doctors thought that she had spina bifida and had wanted us to abort. We didn't, as it turned out. I had cancer. I had stage 2B breast cancer, and we just didn't know it at the time. And I went through traditional therapies of, you know, chemotherapy and surgery. And a year after that, my husband was diagnosed with stage 3B malignant melanoma. He was given a 20 to 30% chance of survival. And a year after that, I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and told that nothing could be done to save me at that point. And in the midst of all of that, I had lost my job, my life insurance, my health insurance, disability insurance, all of that. And so once that happened, I realized that I had to make some pretty drastic changes. And so 14 years later, my husband is walking, our daughter is vibrant and healthy, and we're both cancer-free.
Great. Good. That's wonderful. But you had a lot coming all at once, didn't you?
Yes. It was pretty shocking.
Right, right.
I remember our, you know, friends and family, every time we would pick up the phone and they would get a, you know, a call from us, they'd say, what's happening now?
Then, Joyce, you write that you're getting better with a series of decisions. Talk about these decisions.
Yes, okay. So when I was diagnosed with stage 2B breast cancer, I didn't really make any changes to my life. I pretty much went along with whatever I was told to do, which was to have the surgery and have the chemotherapy. But as far as making changes to my life, I really just wanted to get back to my life as it was. And so my goal, after having lost my job on Wall Street, was just to find another one, get back to work, and get back to what I would call a normal life, right? So it was almost like, let me just get back to what it was like before as if nothing really happened. And so I didn't make any changes. When I was diagnosed with stage 4, and at the time my husband was still dealing with stage 3B, malignant melanoma, which actually they thought was also stage 4, but we left it at 3B. We didn't go any farther. We didn't need to know that it was stage 4. But when I went through that process of being diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and told that nothing could be done to save me, I realized that I needed to start making some changes. And that was when I got down on my knees and I said, God, I know I am not meant to die. Please just show me the way. And the very first thing that I did was I made the decision that I would live. And that's how the name of my book came about, which is Choose to Live. And at that point in time, I said, I will do whatever I'm guided to do, whatever is put in my path that I can trust and move forward with to be able to do this. So I think the first decision was to choose to live. The second was to start trusting the guidance that I had asked for. And I believe we have our own internal GPS system, and we just need to pay attention to that.
The trusting is the hard part, trusting in our own intuition.
It is very challenging.
Yeah. Right, right.
But I think what we do is it's almost like a muscle. The more we exercise it, the better we get at it. And, you know, I have this, I want to say like a little indication. When I hear something for the first time, I say, oh, that's interesting. When I hear it the second time, I say, wow, I really had better pay attention to that. And if I've heard it for the third time, then I know that the first and second time were no mistake and I better take action. So now I've gotten really good at getting it at the second time and even often on the first time.
Right. What is a dying frame of mind versus a living frame of mind to you?
It's a really interesting question. When I was diagnosed with stage 2B breast cancer, I really was very focused on that 15% chance that it might come back. And the devastation that happened with being diagnosed with the stage 2B breast cancer was, one, I did lose everything that I thought was so important to me, which was my job and all of the security that went along with that. But I was also told that I couldn't have any more children. And that to me was true devastation because we had thought, we were in our early 30s. I had only just had my first child. She was 8 months old when I was diagnosed. And so having children was, I felt like my purpose in life. You know, it was, that was the next phase that we were going into. And so when I received that news, I was in such a state of just absolute, just feeling like my heart was ripped out for me not to be able to have children. And it put me in this phase of like, wow, my life as I knew it was not what I thought it was going to be moving forward. And I was very scared. And so I would focus on that, you know, that 15%, but getting back to life in a, just a standard way. the typical American lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
When I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, I had to really shift out of that. And I couldn't focus on the fact that they had said, there's nothing we can do to save you. You are going to die.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So at that point in time, I had to shift out of that and say, well, you know what? Actually, you can't determine my outcome.
Right.
That's between me and my higher power. That's
mm-hmm.
between me and God.
Mm-hmm.
And so someone else, I believe, cannot and should not determine what your outcome is going to be, because I believe we are more powerful than we could ever imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe we have capabilities to heal ourselves that we haven't even tapped into. But in being able to approach life from a living perspective and say, I am going to take each and every day and live my life to the fullest. I'm going to look at each and every day and recognize all the good things that are in it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to look at each and every day and say to myself, wow, I get to live this lifetime right now in this moment, and it can be as good as it can be, or it can be as bad as it can be. But if I want to be here, then why put any energy at all into thinking about dying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I can only be living in this moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think, the dying versus the living frame
mm-hmm.
of mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think that doctors probably mean well, but they often tell patients, especially cancer patients, you have 3 months to live, or you have six
mm-hmm.
months to live, which is doing a disservice because, mm-hmm. you know, our mind has such a powerful influence on our body. And
mm-hmm.
when patients write me and tell me this, I tell them, I say, that is not a medical diagnosis. It's a God diagnosis. And only God knows when we will die. And I was given that diagnosis 40 years ago, and I'm still here. So do not pay much attention to that. Maybe the doctor feels better that he's met his responsibility, but it's not doing you any good to be thinking along those lines. So it's the same thing as you're saying.
Absolutely. My father was diagnosed also with lung cancer, and he said, I've lived my life. I'm ready. I don't want any heroic measures. Just
mm-hmm.
please work, you know, guide me through the process so that I can leave with dignity. And at that point in time, they had said, you're going to have 3 to 6 months to live.
Mm-hmm.
He died 6 months to the day
oh.
that they told him
mm-hmm.
he would.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that happens far too often, and it
mm-hmm.
is a tremendous disservice
right.
to anyone to be given a timeline, you know, in this process. Because if you gave them a 5-year timeline, then they'd be thinking
mm-hmm.
that they're going to live 5 years and live their life as if they were living 5 years
mm-hmm.
or 10 years or 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
It is so powerful.
Right. Joyce, what are some major contributors to common health problems?
Well, as I discovered in this process, and once I started healing my own health issues, which, by the way, I didn't just have late-stage cancer. I didn't have stage 4 cancer as the only thing that was going on with my
mm-hmm.
health. I had chronic fatigue and sinus problems,
mm-hmm.
daily headaches and daily migraines. I had IBS, chronic fatigue,
mm-hmm.
All kinds of health issues. And by changing my diet, my lifestyle, and my approach to life, within 30 days, all those symptoms were gone, and
mm-hmm.
I then went on to start healing cancer. And I had lived with them my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a complete shock to me. And so I then began studying all the different modalities that I used to heal as well, and became certified in different, you know, modalities for healing, because I knew that what I discovered was something that could help a lot of other people. And some of those things that were not just in my case, but I find again and again, are things like heavy metal toxicity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when people are tested for that, sometimes they're just tested at the blood level, but you need to be tested with a challenge, with a urine challenge as well. And so heavy metals is one significant issue. It certainly was in my case. Food intolerance is another issue
mm-hmm.
that I think so many people are living with. Probably 80% of the population is dealing with some kind of a food intolerance. which also, you know, affects your whole gut and digestive tract, which is also where your immune system comes from. Obviously, stress is something that people talk about, but I don't know that they recognize the extent to which stress can be a significant factor. And what I've seen again and again, and I think that there are some studies out about this as well, is that very often within 3 months to 3 years, although I find 2 years is the typical point, there was some kind of a major trauma in somebody's life, and that was that preceded a diagnosis of cancer, typically of cancer, but also of some other health issues as well. So when we have a major trauma, we really do have to address it and not just stuff it down and think that we can just get past it, but to actually be able to heal whatever that trauma was. So I really feel that that was another significant contributing factor, not just in my own health, but in the health of others as well. So those are some of them. Diet is tremendous. Sugar is a significant contributing factor with cancer and really all health issues, but cancer lives on sugar. So that's something that, you know, if you have a high sugar diet or even, you know, any sugar is really not good, especially any refined sugars, but to really be aware of that and pay attention to how much sugar you're actually taking in. You know, things like a smoothie, I won't mention the places, or one of the, you know, the specialty coffees that are the, you know, caramel or what have you, have between 70 and the smoothies can have 120 grams of sugar in them. And so what happens is that, you know, it creates inflammation in the body, it feeds cancer, et cetera, but we're really just not even aware of how much there really is that we're consuming.
Right.
And we're consuming an extraordinary amount of sugar in our lifestyles now.
If you look back at your cancer experience now, would you consider it a blessing in disguise?
Oh, without a doubt. I would say that cancer has been the best thing that ever happened to me. It has been the greatest blessing that has ever happened in my life, and my husband will say the same. And we both feel that it has completely transformed our lives because we recognized that by developing cancer, it was really just a symptom, that our lives were out of balance, that we were not living our life to our fullest potential and caring for our bodies, our souls, in the manner in which we are meant to. And as a result of that, you know, I have become involved in and created this wonderful path of writing a book. I never thought I would write a book and become a best-selling author or be out speaking and teaching and sharing this and discover a passion for life and for sharing and for helping others transform their life that I never would have discovered otherwise. And I'm constantly guided in this process of healing. And then I've created this five-phase approach to healing that is just transforming not only, you know, my own life and my own health and those I love, but of so many others as well. I never could have imagined that I could be so blessed to have this experience for my life.
Then, Joyce, would you tell us about the book and any services you have and how the listeners can reach you and locate your book?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. My website is joyceobrien.com, and that's O-B-R-I-E-N. And my books are available on Amazon.com. They're in bookstores as well. And as far as services, I do work with people at different level of health challenges. We have a team of people here who have just extraordinary experience, and you know, we have years and years of experience combined in doing this. And I take a five-prong approach to healing, which is getting to the root causes at each of the five levels, which would be physical, environmental, mindset, emotional, and spiritual. And by removing the root causes, we have discovered that not only are you able to start improving the way that you feel, but you're able to create something better than you've ever had before. And I don't want to make that, you know, a guaranteed promise, but I want to tell you that that's been our own experience personally and in working with others, because when you start making changes in your life, changes start creating, and especially positive changes, obviously,
mm-hmm.
start creating a whole other level of awareness, not only of your body, but of your surroundings and your choices and how to live your life to its fullest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you very much, Joyce. This has been interesting, and I know it will be helpful to those having cancer that want to use a little bit different approach than the traditional, and will also be encouraging to people that are faced with the diagnosis of stage 3, stage 4 cancer.
Thank you so much. This has been just a wonderful, wonderful experience to have a chance to chat with you.
Thank you, Joyce.
Thank you.
I thank you for joining me today on the Holistic Health Show. I invite you to my websites, www.holistichealthshow.com, where you will find all of the past shows from the last 5.5 years under the blog with a search engine so you can look for a specific topic. You will also find a place to sign up for a free monthly newsletter on holistic health and the latest information on research on cancer, also under the blog. I also invite you to my website, beatlungcancer.net, where you will find information on my latest book, You Can Beat Lung Cancer Using Alternative Integrative Interventions. You will also find endorsements. You will find additional information about the book. And you will also find a site where you can purchase the book from me, or you can also purchase it at Amazon.com. I also invite you to join me on Facebook under Carl Helvey or under Holistic Health Show or under Beat Lung Cancer. I also invite you to join me on LinkedIn under Carl Helvey or on Twitter under Holist Health Show. I hope you've enjoyed the show today, and I look forward to seeing you again in 2 weeks. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host, wishing you a great week.